Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Professors In podcast. We are very happy to have you back after a little hiatus. And as always, I'm very glad that you're here with us today.
You want to tell them who you are?
I am Dr. Karen Kelski of the Professor Is In. And you can find more of me and us on our Facebook page at The Professor Is In, and of course on the blog The Professor Is In, and on Twitter at Professor Is In.
No, the mm-hmm. on Twitter. And I'm Kel Weinhold. I am the productivity coach and interview specialist for The Professor Is In, and it's nice to be back talking with you. We have taken a little bit of time to think about how we can best approach re-examining the advice that we've given over the years to look for places with deficiencies in thinking and awareness. And we got to talking about it. And the first plan was like, let's go through every single blog post we've ever done. And we're certainly going to go back and look at those and complicate them. But we got to talking about Karen's book and how she's working on a second edition, and how much of the book that she would change or complicate and will in this next edition. So we decided for the next several weeks, what we're going to do is we're actually going to go through the book chunk by chunk and look at it within the context of both COVID and the movement for Black Lives, and look for places where we need to really complicate the advice, do a better job at advice, and certainly make some of the advice that we've given more inclusive.
Mm-hmm. So I had already submitted a proposal to my agent, who submitted it to the press, for a second edition of the book. And it was already, the main gist of the second edition was all of those deficiencies in terms of not assuming a white reader, not assuming an able-bodied reader.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the two main ones. Ways that the advice was not really sensitive to the many, many different subject positions that readers can occupy in terms of the academic job market. So I was already in the process of thinking of that. And then the movement for Black Lives came, and then it became, you know, so clear how much more needed to be done. So I'm looking forward to working, to talking through this on the podcast, because there's going to be, well, for one thing, we're like you just said, it's the movement for Black Lives and it's COVID.
Right.
And the financial catastrophe that the academy is confronting right now. And I'm always, you know, a catastrophizer anyway about the academic economy. So I'm like reaching for new vocabulary. Like, what have I not already used to describe right. the academic economy? And now it has to like be more mm-hmm, of that. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to really like looking at these chapters and thinking about the advice. So, you know, in the beginning, it'll be the general advice, the contextualization that was in the first few chapters. And then after that, it gets into more specifics about, you know, laying out a publishing trajectory or writing your cover letter or doing an interview, really right, concrete right. advice. And we're just going to recast it in a new light.
And I want to really invite you to think of this next series as a conversation that we welcome the chance to hear from you, the aha moments that you have, the things that you think that we didn't even talk about that we should have been talking about,
mm-hmm.
examples of your experience. We're always interested in hearing about what this particular section of the job market or the academic life, what that experience was for you. So please do reach out on those platforms or email. It's pretty easy to find us if you just start searching The Professor Is In. You can catch us lots of places, but we really do welcome a conversation around all of these topics.
Yeah, I really want to reiterate that. And also, another tactic that I'll be using for sure is going through the hashtag Black in the Ivory, and that's on Twitter, that's been on Twitter now for about 3 weeks, and studying the content that has revealed itself there about what Black scholars experience from the minute they start in grad school all the way through to, I don't know, retirement, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so just being aware, one of the things about privilege is you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
So this will also include an education effort, you know, an ever more intensive education effort.
Right, right.
As we move forward. So yeah, but just to reiterate, we'd love to hear from you. And this process of doing the second edition of the book is a long process, as you know, because you're academics. So, you know, this is not a thing where I like propose it and then write it and then it goes up in, you know, 3 months. This is at minimum a year process and probably more than that. So there's a lot of time for you to share your stories and I will really take them in.
Yeah, really think of this as a, like, we're workshopping a book. Mm-hmm. We're workshopping the second edition. So welcome to the conversation.
Man, that's so weird for me because the first edition and the business in its entirety in the beginning was Karen.
Right.
Karen, I mean, out in shouting into the wilderness, shaking my fist at the edifice of the academy. You listen to me, you know, howling in the wind. And so it's a really interesting thing to say 10 years later, I've said what I am capable of saying. I have offered what I have to offer. And now, I mean, in a much more humble frame of mind, what don't I know?
Right. Right. You're going to be a little less of a Karen in this second.
A little less of a Karen. Yeah. Amen to that.
Right. So the first section of the book has three parts. The first section of the book is called Dark Times in the Academy. If I were the editor of this section, I might change the title of that.
To not use the word dark.
Well, that would be the first thing.
Yeah. How about that?
Right. I think that I remember one of the first classes that I took as an undergrad where people started to, I mean, I first heard for the first time, why are the black hats always bad and the white hats always good? And I remember just being like 19 and going, oh, what? And my mind was blown.
A million different idioms with black in it.
And then I think that we get lazy about language. So, and I thought, when I saw this, I thought, wow, if we were to call this darker times in the academy, that would be even more problematic. So I really, and then I started laughing and thought we should just call it on the verge of simultaneous extinction and revolution in the academy. That's not quite as pithy.
No, but so basically the very first word of the book is already.
Well, the first significant word. Yeah.
Yeah. Other than the acknowledgments.
Right. Well, other than, okay. Anyway, now you see where we're going.
Yeah. Right. So we're getting into it. All right. So there's that. I think we went off on a riff. What was your point?
But my point is that I think that whole section of the book, right, is really trying to explain to people, look, there was an economic crash. We saw a bloodletting of faculty positions from this point to this point.
Mm-hmm. Since COVID.
No, I'm talking about in the book itself. When you wrote this version, you saw from 2008 or whatever.
From about 19. Well, it started in about 1974. Right. But yeah, basically the really intensification was about 1996 up to when it came out in 2015.
Right. So you were talking about this being this just sort of complete annihilation of the academy, and that has not changed, but now it's on, you know, it's got a virus attached to it. So where we've been seeing shrinking and shrinking, we're now seeing a collapse.
Yeah, as in 400 some on the crowdsourced spreadsheet of canceled and frozen job searches that I put up about 3 months ago. It's over 400 now, and that's, again, not for just 400 campuses. That's 400 mostly campuses plus some entire statewide systems.
Right. And I think that we're hearing, and I can't name all of the universities either because I can't remember them or because the people who have told me these things, I don't feel comfortable naming their universities. But I can say that the number 20 and 25, as in 20% and 25%, I have heard so many times of either of cuts, 25% cut in staff or faculty just across the board, 20 to 25% pay cuts, that we're just seeing a wipeout of of that we have never seen before.
That we've never seen before. In 2008, which is our closest parallel, and you know, the only thing we can really draw on is nowhere in the ballpark.
Right.
Of the pain level nowhere. That we're confronting nowhere. Right now. So
if you saw that, if you, I know in that section you call it the end of an era,
mm-hmm.
that this is the end of another era.
This isn't
that,
the end of another era.
That second era wasn't great.
It was bad.
And now we're in trouble.
I think what I should call that chapter is extinction event.
Yeah.
Although, and that isn't to say that I think Harvard is going to be extinct or Berkeley mm-hmm. or, you know, some of the biggest names that we know of will not be extinct. But many small colleges are not going to survive this. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. There's not.
Including some that we do not microscopically small, obscure colleges, some that we are very familiar with.
Right. That are the regional universities
mm-hmm.
that are scrambling to try to figure out how they're going to keep the whole thing afloat. So yeah. I think that I guess that, you know, I am not like you in that I don't tend to catastrophize. Mm-hmm. You know, I can tend to say, well, you know, if we put it in this context or do this. But the reality is that what we're seeing right now, and we're recording this just the first couple days of July, we're seeing all these, we're going to be back on campus, we're going to be doing this, you're going to be teaching all these things. But so there's a whole bunch of acting like everybody's going to be on their feet come fall. And I have trouble seeing that.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm being Chicken Little and running around, the sky is falling, but really just logically, mm-hmm. I can't see how they're going to manage this.
It doesn't make sense.
Right.
So for more on that, if you do attend to the Professors In Facebook page, our mission certainly for the last number of months has been to foreground every bit of information that we can find from the blogosphere. And that includes daily updates from the Chronicle of Higher Ed and Inside Higher Ed, but also daily updates from the Boston Globe, which follows higher ed news very closely because of Harvard and MIT mm-hmm, and everything. Mm-hmm. And the Washington Post and the New York Times, everybody is covering the reopening plans very, very closely. And so we put those up all the time, and then individual campus news as well. And then also the Movement for Black Lives information up there as well. So anyway, I've been really working on making the Facebook page a clearinghouse of up-to-date information. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So, you know, I know that in the first chapter of the book, you really tried to get people to reset their expectations about what was possible,
mm-hmm.
like economically reset your expectations. And I just want to send a message out to all of you who are who are not in tenure track positions, that this is a time to not pretend like it's going to magically get better.
Mm-hmm.
This is a time to look an extinction event collapse squarely in the eye as you're recalibrating and thinking about what you're going to do in the years to come.
Yeah, that's really important. And, you know, I have heard people ask me questions. They'll pop up on Facebook or the blog and they'll say, well, what do you think I should do while I ride this out? What's the best plan for riding this out for when things get better again? And I really don't like that language
mm-hmm.
because it is the latest, it's the COVID era denial language.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it was probably similar language used in 2008. But the thing is, the hiring of tenure track faculty, tenure track job market, never recovered after 2008.
Right, so it's
starting significantly lower now than it was at the lowest point of 2008. And that was the Great Recession and the crash and a bunch of job searches that were canceled. So in a way, even if you used it back then and you said, I'm going to ride out the Great Recession, very few people were able to ride that out and then actually get the tenure track job at the end of it. And so that language is even less applicable here.
Mm-hmm.
I
guess the question, the thing that I would ask you for the people who are asking how I'm going to ride this out, I would encourage you to change your question to, if this is what it is, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Because this is probably what it is for a very long time.
Yeah.
And that's not to say I don't think that, you know, there might be a day when campuses are open like they used to be open and all of that. I'm not mm-hmm. saying that, but I'm saying that if this is it, what's your plan?
Mm-hmm.
Now, saying that, this is another place I want to try to complicate this a little bit in terms of this sort of broad sweeping advice, right? Don't do this, do this, mm-hmm. don't do that. Is that I think we always have to keep in mind what pursuing a PhD or trying to get a tenure track job and any of those things, what they mean to different individual people. So broadly saying, don't go to graduate school, don't do these things, denies access to opportunities for a whole bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
So modulating that advice to say, if you are someone thinking about going to graduate school, absolutely. And there are some really important caveats that you have to be able to make it without incurring a lot of debt. So where can you get money? Mm-hmm. You have to be able to look at the job market as it stands right now in the field that you want to go into and think from the very beginning about how to take that PhD into a non-tenure track job. Mm-hmm. Thinking about from the very beginning that this is training. Mm-hmm. It's not a respite from the market.
Mm-hmm.
It is, in fact, can be used strategically, mm-hmm. but it's just great care being taken because I think that people get taken advantage of and end up massively in debt with what they wanted, not in reach.
Right. I'm really glad you mentioned that. That is a caution I've heard repeatedly over the years of running the professors in, and I want to foreground it all the time, that if I say from a position of privilege, let's just say this will just stand. I'm not saying I would necessarily say this, but this is just a model, an example. You should not go to grad school in English where you're going to get only $18,000 per year and a stipend and a tuition waiver and kind of really shitty health benefits, because that is, you know, and you're going to be there for 6 years. And then at the end of it, you're not going to have a tenure track job. And so it is a bad investment. Right. Don't do it. That I don't actually say that anywhere. I never say that. But let's take an extreme version of it, like right. that.
But you've said versions of that for sure.
Something along those lines. And people have said, "Hey, hold up, check your privilege." For some people, $18,000 a year, guaranteed for 6 years with health insurance, even if it's shitty, and the chance to have a tuition waiver so you're actually in school all that time, is a way better financial choice
yep.
than a whole bunch of the other ones yep. that are available yep. at that yep. moment. And yep. so I really want to respect that and say, yes, that's true. And if that does, and if grad school makes sense for you as a way to ride out, and I'm going to go back to that language, ride out the really, really, you know, this immediate scary time with a stipend that is more or less guaranteed for a number of years or whatever, even if it's really low, then yeah, that's that. Right. Yeah. Right. Okay. All we want to do here at the Professors Inn is make sure that you don't go into it in denial mm-hmm. about what it's about the promises it's making to you at the end of it,
yeah,
because
absolutely.
That's where they get you. They get you with this idea. Oh, sure, you're gonna have to live on ramen noodles and might have to have a couple roommates, but it's all gonna be worth it because you're gonna be a professor just like me and live the life of the mind. And that's the lie,
right?
So,
and that you can absolutely do that and be as aware and strategic and understanding of the how the market works. And I don't mean the job market. I mean like the whole capitalist market works as you're going through graduate school, never succumbing to the cult-like myth that this is separate from capital.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're going to do that, then you're keeping your eye on the prize of how am I going to make this become the economic boost I wanted it to be. How can I use this to prepare me for a job outside of the academy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great. I'll learn all your stuff about tenure track stuff, but I know that's really a unicorn. And so I'm going to keep the vast majority of my attention on what am I going to do with this mm-hmm. and how am I going to use it as a job or as a economic boost when I get out in outside the academy.
Well, and also if I am, if I'm doing yoga all the way through grad school, you know, and I'm actually a very, very highly accomplished yoga practitioner. This is just an example. You know, who knows?
Right.
Yoga may be the thing you end up leaning on to make an income
right.
for a certain amount of time because teaching jobs, because the fact is you're making more as a yoga teacher than you are as an adjunct.
Right.
If you calculate in all of the elements of it. So as a holistic, well-rounded human being, the goal of graduate school, another goal besides what you just said, is that you remember that you have other skills. Don't forget those other skills.
And don't let them shame you out of them, mm-hmm. right? If you come out of graduate school with a PhD and almost no debt, and you've got to have this experience, and for the next 4 years you work as a yoga instructor, you didn't fail. And that's the part that I wish that we could eliminate from the messaging of inside the cult, is if you didn't get a tenure job, you failed. And I know William Pennebaker talked about that way back when you wrote the first book. I remember him writing extensively about the failure narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I would complicate that advice, you know, even more and more as we look at this next thing of people saying, because I think in economic downturns, people go to graduate school.
Right.
So there's a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to say that. So the thing I thought that was really complicating about this chapter is that I don't think you can just call it extinction event, because simultaneous to this extinction event is also this revolution.
Right.
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 So it's a, mm-hmm. it's a, and I was just thinking, anyway, it's the two of them happening in tandem,
mm-hmm.
in particular in the university, mm-hmm. right? So there's a whole, what's happening in the U.S. writ large, and what's happening in communities, and what's happening with defunding the police, and what's happening with all of the sort of raised awareness
mm-hmm.
out there.
Mm-hmm.
But what's going to happen in the academic cocoon, I think, is also going to be a revolution,
mm-hmm.
and for good and for bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So be specific. What do you mean? Because you're assuming that everyone knows what you mean, but what you mean is that the university has to figure out that Black Lives Matter.
Yes.
That's what you're saying.
No, well, I'm saying that. Thank you for... just felt like I got schooled somehow, like I was being edited while talking.
Well, it's just that you and I talk nonstop every day, all day, 24/7.
About all these issues, so
days
we,
a year.
We have to forget.
And I think that not everybody's necessarily in
the conversations,
in the conversations with us in the house.
No, what I said I thought that there was going to be a revolution, it was the end for good and for bad. Here are the two things that I was holding in that moment in my head.
Mm-hmm.
One is that I expect there to be, in contrast to everything that we just said, I expect the money that is spent in many, many universities will be on creating programs, creating institutes, creating all sorts of things as a response to the movement for Black Lives, centering race, and that we actually might see an increase in hiring of scholars around race,
mm-hmm.
particularly Black scholars around anti-Blackness.
Mm-hmm.
So I can absolutely see that happening,
mm-hmm.
which is great, and it also gives me tremendous pause,
mm-hmm.
because I think the university has so completely failed to support the Black scholars that are there, to create systems of support, to create an understanding of the experience of being Black in the ivory,
mm-hmm.
that an explosion of hiring is not going to solve that. And so I can imagine it being a setup.
Yeah.
And that's where I think that white faculty need to be getting themselves ready to be the kind of allies to say, it's not enough that you just open the Institute for the Study of Black this or that.
Mm-hmm.
We need to make sure that X, Y, Z are in place across mm-hmm. campus to make this not just performative and ultimately destructive.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I guess I'm a little bit stuck on your initial premise. I hope your premise is right.
Yeah.
That there's going to be a bunch of money put into hiring Black faculty and opening centers for the study of race. But I don't know. I mean,
maybe I'm naive there.
I just don't know. And that's me. And I feel that way every day, actually, these days, just sitting and looking and watching and reading the news every single day and thinking, when is this going to get squelched? When is the...
Yeah, you're probably right.
When are the forces of forgetting and resistance and denial going to come and
when
wash?
When is white supremacy going to squeeze us out?
When is white supremacy going to squeeze us out? Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And so, no, I didn't mean, but I don't mean that in a deflating way.
No,
I think
maybe that is naive on my part. Maybe I was thinking, I'm going to see a lot of reaction and a lot of knee-jerk stuff. And maybe the knee-jerk stuff will just end at the really bad, we're against racism.
Renaming
statement.
Buildings.
Right, right. Maybe they'll just stop at renaming buildings.
And
maybe
down a statue or two.
Right. And I'm not discounting the value of that.
Of course.
I'm just saying that I might have even overreached in what I thought their rebound response would be. Mm-hmm. Their poorly worded letters and renaming a building, they may think that they've now solved anti-blackness on the American campus. So I stand.
No, we'll see.
Possibly corrected.
We don't know.
But whatever the case may be, I guess my bottom line is that I have absolutely no faith in the university to respond to this in a way that ultimately uplifts and encourages and supports Black faculty.
Absolutely.
And I think that what I'm most afraid of is that we're going to see a departure of Black faculty.
Mm-hmm.
That we're going to see, I have seen this and I've done this and now you're going to do this. You know what? I'm out.
Well, you were saying that some of the faculty you know of are talking about leaving.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just see that bubble up in different places on Twitter and the like. People saying it might be time to be done with this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that in the fact that I know them by watching them on Twitter.
I think there's a lot of pain. There must be. I mean, now this is me. I'm not, as a white person, I do not know this experience, but it seems from having read a lot of Black writing in this exact moment that there's also a lot of pain in the fact that you've been fighting this fight and trying to get people to listen and saying you're killing us, we're dying, and our communities are in crisis. And it's like, no, they're not. No, they're not. No, they're not. No, you're not. No, you're not. No, you're not. Oh, oh my goodness. You were right. Oh, there is racism. Oh,
and then I'm going to read it in a book.
Yeah. But now I'm going to read Robin DiAngelo and nice white lady's going to tell me how there's racism. You know, I can imagine there must be tremendous pain. It must be very galling. In some ways.
And again,
it's not just like, oh, yay, you kindly heard me. No, it's like, fuck you very much.
Yeah, and you don't have to imagine that. I mean, you can read across the social media and see different people's response to it. And I think the most significant question being, why did you all show up right now?
Mm-hmm.
We could get into a whole discussion of that. But
I was only trying to link it to the fact that Black faculty who are here right now, that a very naive and highly privileged white gays might say, oh, it must be easier for you now because people have stopped gaslighting. And I think that I just want to say it is quite the opposite. It could be quite the opposite.
Yeah,
it's like, no, it's actually now might be exactly the moment when you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I cannot even.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. 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 That's what I've been thinking about that just a lot, about what it means to be, what it means to be in pain. And I think about it like a pinch wound, like somebody squeezing your finger, or you get your finger pinched in something really hard and it's stuck and it hurts at first. And then it just gets weirdly numb.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you release the pressure, it's just screaming pain.
Right.
And that's what I just keep thinking about lately. Mm-hmm. But I do think that one of the things that where the university is going to fail and where the university is where I want to encourage white faculty to really start to do the work is a failure to acknowledge the people who were trying to do this that didn't get listened to, that didn't get tenure, the programs that didn't, that all of the people who were doing the work, because I think it'd be so easy to go in there, you know, with your five books that you've just read and you're like ready to be the ally and you're marching in there and with no acknowledgement of the pain or the dismissal or all the other stuff of the faculty of color who were on the front lines trying to do it, and because of all multitudes of reasons are not there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that one of the things we continue to fail to do is reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
We continue to fail to actually stop and acknowledge what happened, what pain was caused. It just reminds me of that Malcolm X quote where he talks about sort of like, you know, the knife in your back of white supremacy, of mm-hmm. anti-Black violence. And it's like 6 or 9 inches in. I can't remember the exactly. And, you know, it gets pulled out 3 inches and you're supposed to like be relieved. Mm-hmm. And then even if it gets pulled out all the way, that's supposed to be good enough. There's mm-hmm. no stopping and acknowledging you just had a 9-inch knife in my back.
Right.
So I think that's where I am concerned. Well, as you're writing this section, talking about like what the university has to do to stop and say, we need reconciliation around race on American campuses.
Right.
Starting with the whole range of experiences of Black, Indigenous, and people of color on campus. That we can't just like jump from, mm-hmm. oh, this was terrible. Now there was a bunch of marches and now it's all
right,
better.
Right. So, absolutely.
That's the section in that kind of new era.
Right. And yes. Yes.
Of that book right there. It's like really looking at what that new era mean.
Absolutely. I'm concerned that about all the ill-informed white people who are going to start trying to teach about race.
Right.
And do it badly.
Right.
Because now there are all these calls. We all have to incorporate race into our teaching. And
we do.
And very, very few people have done the hard lifting to be able to do that. Right. White people, I should say. Let me be very clear.
Right.
So, yeah. Anyway.
So I think, yeah. So the next section of this first chunk mm-hmm. Is breaking out of the ivory. And this is really where you talk about sort of the mythology mm-hmm. of the storytelling of about the tenure track job, which we already covered in previous comments.
But. Right. And the idea that it's separate from, you know, that you can't monetize it, you can't instrumentalize it, you can't attach it to salary. And that leads into a whole bunch of behaviors. The mythologizing leads to behaviors, which is, I'm not going to ask for money. I'm not going to ask for what I'm worth. I'm not going to ask for adequate compensation. I'm not going to say no to exploitative work conditions. Mm-hmm. All of those things. I don't know if I actually don't remember if I spell them out all that much in this introductory part. I know I do later in the book, but that's what's got to that needs to change. That needs to become quite a bit more Karen-ish, which is stop now.
Right.
Stop the exploitation. You cannot. So if you're a tenured reader and an administrator reading this, I'm talking to you, you know, shame on you, stop it. But really, my voice is always, I'm always really speaking to the folks who are, you know, just starting out and trying mm-hmm. to find their footing. And then that is really very much, they're going to try to exploit you. The only one who can stop it from happening is you.
Mm-hmm. And so the other day, I was in working in my office and Karen was in the other room working and I came marching down the hallway and said, I have had an epiphany. she, again, for good or for bad, is very used to that. But I said, I have the perfect example of how faculty separate themselves from capitalism. Mm-hmm. When this whole pandemic started and the administration, meaning management, decreed everybody's going online, you now have to put your classes online.
With like a weekend. Or at most, pretty much most people had a week.
Well, most people had their spring break.
Oh,
they're actually
right.
not paid vacation.
That's right. I forgot about that.
And now I'm sure they're out there and I just haven't heard from them, but every single person I talked to, heard from, read on Twitter, saw on Facebook, well, not Facebook, because I don't do that, but and wherever, Instagram, you name it, were people saying, oh my gosh, I had to put my entire course online. I had to spend my whole spring break doing this. And so what I said to Karen is, if faculty understood themselves as part of capitalism,
wage laborers,
they would have understood that that was additional labor and they would have negotiated. Mm-hmm. They would not be working at Walmart and somebody said, we need to redo all the shelves because of COVID and mm-hmm. now they have to, everything has to be delivered out the back door. Mm-hmm. And they said, sure, I'll spend my weekend doing that, no pay. They would have said, I can do that. But that is a change in the labor agreement that we have. Now, I know that people can come back at me and say, well, our faculty union said we had to, and great. Then what happens is this increased labor means that there needs to be a change in the expectations for tenure. Mm-hmm. There needs to be an change in the expectations for what you're going to get from me during this time. But there has to be a negotiation around that labor. Mm-hmm. And what I saw is people make themselves literally sick.
Yes.
To accomplish something that managers decreed had to be done.
And which, I mean, we all, I'm sure, agreed was for the greater good. I mean, it was the students had to keep learning. The classes had to go on.
No, therefore, they don't.
They had to be switched online. Like, everybody was like, but my students. In other words, what I'm trying to say is I'm actually not disagreeing with you. I'm agreeing with you that it's because of these mythologies.
Right.
It's because of the ivory tower, because you're never allowed to monetize academic labor.
Right.
That this could happen.
But your devotion to your students, your devotion to
the greater good, your devotion to pedagogy. No, it's wage labor. It's making lattes at Starbucks, except it's teaching students and you should get paid for it.
Well, and I would, okay, let's put it, actually, the categories that I use when I coach and when I write about is that I use the professional categories of attorney mm-hmm, or doctor and yeah. that you are in the same categories. You're in the same category of, you know, required education to have your job, yada, yada, yada. In those categories, once again, if you're working extra shifts in the ER because of COVID, if you're working extra things in the, you know, as you're negotiating the new contracts in a COVID environment, you're getting paid.
Yes.
You're getting your hourly billing if you're an attorney. You're having overtime if you're a doctor. You're not just working.
Yep.
And so that... So, you know,
and if any of you have ever listening today, if any of you have ever had the misfortune of having to engage deeply with an attorney over a long time, you know, how those bills come in. They 15-minute increments. They don't miss a trick.
Right.
There is not a phone call. There is not an email that is not billed.
Right. Because it's work.
It's work.
So all of this to say, as you're looking now at the fall and they're saying, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do this. I really want you to encourage you to start talking to each other about how to negotiate those things as part of an increase in your labor and what that's going to mean and whether that's through cash or it's through offset mm-hmm. in the future. That I mm-hmm. think that's where in this breaking out of the ivory tower section that you did in the setup of it, I would like to see more focus on capitalism, like really on the insidiousness mm-hmm. of capitalism written underpinning what's being sold as a calling. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the calling, right? Mm-hmm. You talk about all that. I would love to see a little bit more like hard. Yes. This is capitalism.
Right.
This is you as a laborer.
Job. And your professional work is labor.
Right. You're a professional.
Yeah.
Okay. But that doesn't make you managerial.
Right.
Right. It doesn't make you an owner of the means of production.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So that's what I would advocate for mm-hmm. in that section.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last section is myths grad students believe. And
that's about exceptionalism that is rarely becomes explicit until for most of the years you're in a PhD program until the very, very end. It's implicit, though. It's not. It's always there. It's like, well, I mean, well, first of all, in the beginning years, it's, I haven't read your book. No, I haven't read the blog. I started to read it. It was too scary, so I put it down. And then they continue to not read it until they're in their sixth or seventh year and they're going out on the market. And then suddenly the exceptionalism and the denial falls away, but uh-huh. it has been completely rampant until that moment, which right. is I know the job market's bad, but I just can't think about that.
Right.
Well,
and that's one of those areas that I think it's, I want to hear from people more of their experience in graduate school, because I don't know if that sense of coming in and thinking people are going to take care of me, people are on my side, I'm going to have advocates, this is going to be a great relationship with my advisor. I'm going to be the one who figures out how to get a job. I know I have a good advisor. I've had this or that. I don't know whether that sort of entitlement attitude is pervasive or not. I don't mm-hmm. know whether I'm seeing from what I heard from sort of more white middle class people when I was in graduate school, or whether that is a pervasive whether it takes that sort of sense of I'm going to do it to even mm-hmm. go to graduate school. So I'd really mm-hmm. like to hear where and how we can address that question of how to tell people, hey, wake up, without, you know, blowing past a bunch of people who've already very clear on that.
Well, we can complicate it a little right now. It is absolutely, we have talked for a long time about how it's very much wrapped up in white supremacy and white entitlement. The myth of meritocracy and the fact that so many white grad students who are so accustomed to doing everything right and then being rewarded for doing everything right. And so most of the quit lit literature that is these exposés of the horror and the exploitation and the lies told by the academy and the scandal of it all, you know, they're written by white people because the white people are the ones who are so shocked that they did everything right and continued to be a straight A student all the way through their PhD, wrote that great dissertation, defended it, la, la, la. And there wasn't a job at the end of waiting for them.
But I did everything right.
Yeah. But I did everything right. So it's absolutely interwoven with systems of white supremacy.
And which is interwoven with that idea that just because you put in your best effort, you get what you quote unquote deserve, mm-hmm. which is, you know, false on its face. All right. So thank you very much.
We had the point that we talked about right before we started about, you know, the very last line of the first section it's one of the last lines. It's your advisor are you upset that your advisor doesn't have your back?
Right.
I say your advisor, remember your advisor gets their paycheck, whether you get a job or not. Your advisor can pay his mortgage, whether you can make rent or not. Are you upset that your advisor doesn't have your back? Have your own back.
Right.
And I would not change that.
Right.
That's core. That is central. That is the absolute sort of mission statement of the professor is in. But I think that, in thinking about how to complicate it, though, I think that the different people walk into grad school with different levels of naivete.
Right.
And so I think a lot of scholars of color are very aware that you can't just put your trust in an advisor.
In an individual.
Yeah. In an individual. And so knowing that you need to walk in with this skepticism is something that it's not a universal, the naivete and right. the investment in the mythology is not universal.
Right.
And it may very well reflect a white point of view mm-hmm. primarily. So mm-hmm. I think that's another piece of work that the introduction can do.
Yeah, I wonder too, this is not to discount the white part of that. I also wonder about that in terms of class.
Oh yeah.
Because I certainly came coming in as working class into the university. I was incredibly skeptical and really didn't believe that somebody was going to have my back because that's not what you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the more you live in that state of I worked hard, I got straight A's, I went to this school, I got that job, I got into this college, the less bumpy your road is, mm-hmm. the harder the smack is when you realize that, you know, that person that you were so interested in studying with, who may be a good person, is not your going to be your salvation or your, mm-hmm. In many, 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 many cases, not your advocate.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in many cases, actually your detriment.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
there we go. Thanks for joining us.
That was helpful. Thanks for listening. And if you have any reactions to this at all, we are all ears. So please send them along.
All right. See you next week.
Bye.